Late Night Live. Ideas and opinions from around the world.
G'day, beloved listeners. Welcome to Late Night Live. Later on in the program, I'll be introducing you to Dorothy Green. Now, I knew her a little, a remarkable woman. She had to buy her clothing from the children's stores because she was so little. But by heaven, she bestrode this planet like a colossus. And Willem MacDonald has written a lovely little book about her, Warrior for Peace, and she'll be in a little later when all will be revealed. Now, Gladys have all witnessed Kevin Rudd's We Deserve a Great Big Whacking Roadshow. Potties on distant parts of the globe should try YouTube. But this prime ministerial self-flagellation might have been avoided entirely if the government had delivered earlier on another of those pesky election promises. In this case, the promise of open government. The home insulation rollout turned into a debacle. And prime ministerial flagellation, after it was revealed that a report warning of the dangers had sat apparently unread, certainly not acted upon for months. If the Minter-Ellison risk assessment had been made public at the time, it might have caused brief embarrassment, but it would have compelled the government to fix the problems and to be seen fixing them. Governments, especially prior to their election, like to promise openness, but the commitment tends to wane in office, and before the 2007 election, the Rudd opposition promised to embrace openness in government by way of public participation, and then it established a Government 2.0 task force, which delivered a report just before Christmas, pithily titled, you try saying pithily this time of the night, pithily titled, Engage. The report says that by using the collaborative tools of the internet, known as Web 2.0, government will be more democratic, participatory and informed, government policy more relevant, public servants more engaged, and it will unlock vast amounts of information held by governments. Now, that all sounds bonza. Of course, there are political and practical impediments. As we await the government's response tonight, we'll discuss open government in view of the 2.0 report, the ideals, the risks and the realities, with three well-credentialed guests. Nicholas Gruen is Chief Executive of Lateral Economics. Nicholas was Chair of the Government 2.0 Task Force. He's in our Melbourne studio, or rather he's squeezed into a TARDIS. From our Canberra studio, we welcome Andrew Podger. Andrew is National President of the Institute of Public Administration Australia. He was the Australian Public Service Commissioner from 2001 to 2004, and before that, he scaled the dizzy heights of the public service without using oxygen. And on the phone from Brisbane, we're joined by David Moore. David runs a consultancy business, The Next Level, and he was Chief of Staff to the former Indigenous Affairs Minister, Mal Brough. Gentlemen, welcome to our little wireless program. Nick, your report says that by embracing the collaborative nature of the latest web software, Web 2.0, the government will be more democratic, participatory and informed. We'll get into some of the details soon, but that statement suggests that enormous advances are not only possible, but almost technologically determined. Give us a brief overview.
Well, I don't think it's a matter of technological determinism. These technologies really have become ubiquitous now, things like Wikipedia, blogs and so on, and it all depends on how you use them. But, I mean, let me just tell you a simple story which to me makes this kind of thing fairly real. I expect you don't know who Tanta is. Most people don't.
May I confess that you're absolutely right.
Now, Tanta is the pseudonym of somebody who left the mortgage industry in America 7 years ago, went to work in the she was an English academic, went to work in the mortgage industry, and she started blogging about the mortgage industry. At the time, when the mortgage industry, when everybody started to become interested in what the hell was going on in the subprime market, they turned to her blog. And she was so good at what she did that she started being linked to by Nobel Prize winners. Then she got quoted by the US Federal Reserve in its research. They didn't know who she was any more than you do. They knew that what she wrote made sense. In fact, she has subsequently died. She was at home sick. She had ovarian cancer. That's a little story about how... Now, none of that could have happened 20 years ago. If you wanted to get quoted by the US Federal Reserve, if you wanted the little piece of information that you had to be heard, you would have had to spend 10 or 15 years writing papers, attending conferences and so on. So this is an incredible new technology for finding the right piece of information, the person with the expertise, the person with the local knowledge to help you out on a particular matter.
Now, Nick, I remember Obama issuing a presidential memorandum on his first day, ordering the heads of government agencies to make as much information available as possible, quote, with a clear presumption, in the face of doubt, openness prevails. Extrapolate that to Australia. How might 2.0 participation work here?
Well, basically... it's essentially the same idea. At the moment, if there is a piece of information, let's say it's a mailing list for a, you know, the ACCC or any piece of information, then there is a presumption. There is a presumption now that it's not open, that it's not available unless you can get access to it through the Freedom of Information Act. And in fact, you can be put in jail for releasing it if you don't have authorization to do so. So what's at issue here is simply reversing that presumption. There may be good reasons why you don't release the mailing list. You know, if it's businesses, maybe there aren't privacy issues. If there are individuals, perhaps there are. But the presumption is it's open unless you can demonstrate a reason for keeping it confidential.
Nicholas, where would you put up barriers to openness? One assumes that diplomatic problems might have to be kept in the drawer.
Yeah, that's right. Well, basically, privacy, confidentiality, and security. The new Freedom of Information Act explicitly says that embarrassment to a government or an agency is not a reason not to release information. And we didn't reiterate that, but you know, I'm doing it now for you. That's, you know, we're moving to a time where there is this massive value in information, and we haven't gone into that yet, but there is massive value in, I mean, just to give you another example, when the government sent out the stimulus checks, it staggered the payments by postcode, and some economists want to get hold of the list of when they sent the checks where, so they to work out how effectively that $20 billion was spent. Under the law at the moment, they, you know, kind of have to say, please, please, please. But I think you can appreciate that that's immensely valuable information which should be presumed to be available to anyone who wants it unless there's a good reason not to make it available.
Now, Nicholas, Andrew and David, address the example from my introduction to you tonight, the release of information, in this case information the government didn't release, on the risks involved in the now legendary home insulation rollout. I'd like to ask you, Andrew, how should the Rudd government 2.0 have handled that?
It's a bit difficult for me to say too much on that one because I happen to be chair of the Audit Committee of the Environment Department, Philip. But let me say just a couple of points nonetheless. There are public interest benefits in certain things being held confidential. I agree very much with what Nicholas is saying, that the things should be made public unless there is a public interest case against that. In principle, that's what the old FOI Act had anyway. But in this case of a risk assessment made during a process by which government is making its decisions, if that had been made public right there and then, you would find that the way the media operates, a government public service which is generally risk-averse would become even more risk-averse. There are certain things which, in the processes of making decisions, are best not brought into the public arena. They are part of the deliberative process of making decisions.
Okay, let's go to David now, who was involved in a very contentious area. Because, David, you're at the centre of the internal discussions about a very big and controversial policy, the Northern Territory intervention.
Indeed.
How open was that? And how open could it have been, in your view?
The antecedents, of course, to the Northern Territory response, of course, came out of the Little Children Are Sacred report. So in effect, the then government didn't, whilst it was very much aware of the broad scale of the issues involved, wasn't in fact privy to the underlying issues in that report until very late in the process. So in a funny sort of way, that example, the federal government was almost as excluded as the rest of the public were, and we became aware of the findings of that report about a week and a half before, about a week before the Prime Minister made an announcement. The real issues around consultation then happened subsequently, so they became implementation issues, and certainly in the context of this discussion, I mean, it's interesting because the way Indigenous people engage and relate to information, this sort of framework wouldn't necessarily have helped us at the current level of technology and the current level of access.
But David, it's also clear you were playing it pretty close to the chest because of the immense significance of what you were doing.
I don't think a national press conference is keeping it close to your chest, to be honest. But I think Andrew makes a good point. I mean, the difficulty in the discussion processes, I mean, there are all sorts of things discussed at various stages which the internal process quite often dismisses as not being possible, whether it's with consultation or without. And those sorts of things can be completely misjudged in the public arena because they're not even seriously taken up by government, if you sort of understand my point. I mean, frankly, I think Andrew would agree, you get some silly ideas in government and government dismisses them.
But they don't dismiss all of them quite often. They actually implement them.
If only they dismissed all of them. Absolutely.
Yeah. Well, look, we're not here to gang up on you, David, but Nicholas, what did you think about the way that particular issue was handled in terms of public debate or openness?
I'm not sure that I have any strong views on the question of openness. I guess I had a private view that the thing seemed to be done for as a media event, and as David has said, between getting the report and producing an all-singing, all-dancing and very serious policy response, there was, sort of a weekend and a few days. Now, that doesn't seem to me to be particularly responsible, but I take David's point that there was quite an open process in advance of that. So, if the Prime Minister at that stage had come out and said, look, we're incredibly serious about this, we're prepared to do whatever it takes, including sending in the army, and really getting heavy with people to make sure that we defend the basic rights of these children, then I think that sounds fine. And at that stage, you then go and talk to the people whom you are going to be intervening on and get their advice. And that it didn't quite happen in that order.
This is LNL on Radio National, abc.net.au/RN. The topic, Open Government, the Ideals and the Realities. My guests, Nicholas Gruen, Chair of the Government 2.0 Task Force, Andrew Podger, National President of the Institute of Public Administration Australia, and David Moore, former Chief of Staff to Mel Brough, the Howard Government Minister for Indigenous Affairs. Andrew, let's give the Gladys and Poddies a reminder of the context of freedom of information. It was introduced in the early 1980s here. I think it was mid-60s in the USA. Perhaps we could call that Open Government 1.0. How did FOI transform open government, in particular the work of public servants? Because I remember when it came in, I was chairing a government organisation, and we decided we wouldn't put so much in writing.
I think it's fair to say at the time it came in, and it was actually basically prepared under the Fraser government, following some work by the Whitlam government, but the Fraser government was actually the one who did the hard yards on the legislation. That the senior public service at that time was advising very firmly against it, primarily because of the concern about the way in which they would work with their ministers. Now, I think that most of them went overboard on that. However, the facts are that while everybody talks about the public service culture, that culture is enormously shaped by the culture of ministers and their staff.
And the media.
And which, well, that's right, and which in
which
turn
is
shaped by the is shaped yep. by the media, and the a professional minister and his staff have to respond to the way the media operates. Yeah. So your example you had of why didn't the government release the Minters report on risk analysis? Well, if departments released the risk analysis of every proposal that comes forward before the proposal is decided upon and before they've made decisions on how to mitigate those risks, we'd never do anything. The publicity would be, this is going to cause all the terrible strife. People are going to die. Don't do it. So you have to say, well, there has to be a process to allow deliberative decisions to be made without the glare of publicity. But there's an issue then, sometime afterwards that material ought to be made public.
Mm.
There's also an issue here that, you know, as time went by, first of all, the first stage was people found it wasn't quite as terrible as people thought it was going to be. But I'd have to say, over the 90s, you got a shift the other way, that the exemptions from the FOI Act started to be used. So instead of not releasing for public interest, it was not releasing for partisan interest. Mm. And that's where I started to get worried that, in fact, the public service, at the pressure of ministers, was starting to not seriously go back to the principles of what the Act was all about. And I'm pleased to see, you know, that is being fixed up substantially by the changes that have been brought out over the last 12 months.
Nicholas and David, first of all, Nicholas, a response?
Look, I think that's pretty right. One of the central strengthenings of the FOI Act is the involvement of the Information Commissioner and the involvement of independent agency, an independent officer to make the decision. And, you know, governments are full of what you might call Sir Humphrey policies, which is that they're policies which are agreed upon in principle and they're loudly proclaimed, but then on individual cases, discretion prevails and they're not implemented. So I think that's good.
Nicholas, I suddenly recall, of course, you worked very closely with at least two ministers I knew, John Button and then Jim Dawkins. Now, they had very different personalities, very different attitudes, I would have thought, to making things public. Did you have to cut your cloth accordingly?
No. The things that became public were, you know, as a staffer, you are so subservient on that point, on the point of what gets released, that it's, you know, it's not really a matter of... I think they both operated according to the default that the department gave them, but John Button had looser lips and sank more ships.
David, did you sink many ships?
Most of them stayed floating, thankfully. I think certainly my experience was that where FRI requests were received within the department and an officer made a decision, I can't recall an instance where there was any interference in that process and information was released. Now, that's not to say that from time to time you were glad that certain requests didn't come in, but most certainly you wouldn't have interfered with it. I think one of the things we miss here, and sort of coming back to the point about the insulation process, is that it doesn't necessarily mean the substantive policy decision is a good one. So if you're actually dealing with participative democracy where you're building a policy from the ground and you've exposed it to a whole series of pluralist influences, you know, in the public domain, you might end up with a better policy. If the policy decision is essentially already taken, i.e. we're going to spend a lot of money and give people pink bats, And the substantive question is, how fast can you get it out there? It really doesn't matter whether it's been participative or not. I mean, I don't think we would have discovered any more risks or any fewer risks by that being dealt with publicly. The government actually knew that risk was there.
Nick, the 2.0 Task Force report says public servants should get online so as to, and I quote, equip the public sector with better informed public servants by encouraging them to interact directly with the community so as to better appreciate their needs. I find it very hard to simply to cope with the hate mail I get. You know, how are these bureaucrats, how are these fellas going to cope with the bombardment of data requests, the complexities, documentation?
Look, there are sort of a bunch of things in that question. Let's talk about public discussion. One of the points that we made in the report is that public servants, that there's this sort of dichotomy. They ask the question, is this sort of a private matter, in which case they can kind of discuss it at their low, you know, public servants can be members of political parties or anything they like, and they can privately make statements, or is it in their official capacity? And this dichotomy kind of drove me mad, because there's very little you can say in your official capacity, and, you know, people want some kind of intelligent discussion of something. It doesn't mean you have to make major concessions or something, but the what is missed out there is the room for professional discussion, discussion about what good government involves. So it's appropriate for public servants to retreat away from politically contentious discussion, and that will change over time.
You say quite emphatically that in a professional and respectful manner, APS employees should engage in robust policy conversations.
Yes, and the good news is that's not what we said. That is from the Australian Public Service Commission's guidelines on online engagement. So all those public servants who are listening out there, you have a public invitation to start exploring this space, start finding out what it means, start finding out where the trouble is and what you can't say, and let's hear a lot more of all those things that you can say, which are about quality policy and all of the things that you think about from day to day.
Andrew, how far up this departmental ladder should the activity that Nick's describing go?
Well, I hasten to say that the Commissioner quite rightly puts also in about the importance of agencies having internal protocols and approval processes, that it's not as simple as saying, yes, go out there and have a go. I mean, I'm pleased to see some reversal of the pressures of recent years, which have meant that a lot of departments stopped publishing as much as they were publishing, stopped making speeches as much as they do. For a number of years, back in the 80s, the finance department, you could go through their documents and enormous amount of material was publicly available. If you look for the number of speeches during the period from about 1998 to 2005, you find basically none.
I wonder why.
That contraction was one of the things that worried me. But the idea that suddenly everybody could go out and have blogs, have their names there and say, look, we're dealing with this policy issue and this is the thing we're thinking about. What do you think? And it's an issue that is actually being considered very closely by the government and ministers and might come up in the budget. I think there'll be all sorts of protocols as who's allowed to do that, under what circumstances and all the rest of it. And it won't be open blather.
David, I want to put you back in the role of a ministerial advisor. Would you be happy for public servants in your minister's department to be involved in these online debates about an unfolding and controversial government policy?
I certainly think that there is a role for this. I mean, I take Nicholas's point, and I think that more participative processes are better, and certainly that should be sort of explored. I actually feel a little bit sorry for the officers in the public service, though, because they're between a rock and a hard place. I mean, the reality is that it's very hard for them to separate those sorts of consultation processes from the exigencies of the political and the budgetary process. I mean, and some of those are tied up, you know what I mean, with cabinet submissions, which have certain protections. So it is a very hard high wire rack for senior public servants to walk.
David, it also varies, of course, from level to level of government. In the municipal area, this sort of argy-bargy and interaction is much more common, but it seems to diminish as we go up the chain.
I think that you're dealing with substantially different issues. You're not dealing with national security issues. You might be dealing with sort of sewage and planning issues, although many people would argue that planning decisions aren't as open as they would like to be at local government level.
Open participation has clear benefits for local governments, which become debatable or problematic at, say, the federal level.
And can I also make the point, though, that we've got to be very careful here, because I still think that there's a qualitative issue which still makes me a little uncertain in this space. If these processes essentially give weight to volume of information rather than quality of information, I'm not sure that you get a better policy outcome. And that's one of the difficulties. How do you sift out of that massive information and input, which in itself is a public good, and sift out what are the critical elements which actually might see a policy unravel or see a policy work.
David, I'm glad you've raised this issue, because we are now going to go off in a different direction. Nick, by amazing coincidence, the cover story in the latest edition of The Economist is the data deluge. And let me quote, according to one estimate, mankind created 150 exabytes, that's 150 billion gigabytes of data, in 2005. This year it'll be 8 times that amount. Merely keeping up with this flood and storing the bits that might be useful is difficult enough. It has great potential for good as long as consumers, companies and governments make the right choices about when to restrict the flow and when to encourage it. It is a daunting prospect, isn't it?
Well, yes, but one of the most powerful ways of working, of sifting through the dross, is to release stuff. Now, there may be reasons why you can't do that, privacy, all sorts of things. But the National Library has crowdsourced people to help it digitize its newspapers. They put up a picture and then they digitize it automatically with a computer. And then people, if they see mistakes that the computer has made, they can correct it. Now, that is generating a lot of data now about which newspaper articles people want, are most important. And that, therefore, becomes extremely valuable data to work out where to put your priorities. So there are so many ways.
You're suggesting almost a free market version of activity.
Well, Google calls it data exhaust, stuff that people used to throw away. It finds all sorts of, useful information in who, here's 10, you've searched for home loans or whatever, and here's a list of 10, but most people seem to click on number 7. That's giving you information about people's priorities.
One of my favourite lines has always been, data isn't information, information isn't knowledge, and knowledge isn't wisdom. But what you're proposing, Nick, can move you down that continuum.
Just slightly. That's right.
Philip, if I can make a couple of points to unpack this, I think Nicholas is onto something very important in terms of increasing public access to data banks held by public servants. Now, some of those data banks will need some re-engineering to handle things such as privacy and so on, so you don't get any way you can track a particular record. But thinking of all the information held by Medicare Australia on the PBS and the MBS, there's a huge amount of data there which would be greatly useful for a number of researchers to get. The Public Service Commission database on public servants, a wonderful database. So there's a lot of stuff there. But I think there's a very different set of issues about the blogs. And on the issue of active involvement in blogs, I think there is room for it, but I think this idea of where the protocols lie is going to be quite important because there is an issue of maintaining the trust of ministers in their public service. If you read Nikki Savvas's most recent book, you'll see the classic line from a media advisor is, don't let anybody in the public service talk to anybody out there in the public at all. And that is a standard line from media advisors for ministers under any government.
Now, the Rudd government is today, and now I'm quoting February the 26th, has today appointed Professor John McMillan as the Information Commission designate. Andrew, how important will the Information Commissioner be?
I think it's very important. I'm very pleased about setting up the position. I'm very pleased about John McMillan's appointment. John has been an expert and an advocate in information issues for 35 years. He came in to be the ombudsman a few years ago and has done an excellent job there. And I think his independence is acknowledged by everybody, but also his expertise and good judgment. But the issue is about his independence. And I think he does understand that there are lines to be drawn about where the public interest lies in these things. He's not going to say everything should be out there, but he will be able to make judgments and over time might help the public service to understand where those lines ought to be drawn.
David, do you have a view on the Information Commission and its designated leader?
Certainly not on the person or the leader. In relation to the position, I think you do need this sort of oversight and role. I mean, the proliferation of information, how it's going to use, what the protocols around it are critically important, because I think that there is the difference between the public interest and the right to access information, and then those people who are employed by government to try to manage government processes. There's two completely different sets of needs there, and this is a whole new evolving field of sort of policy and having appointments in that field, I think, is basically a good thing.
Nick, what sort of powers will he have?
We would like him to have the power. Essentially, we've recommended that the things are open by default, and if someone wants to close them, someone wants not to release something, they do so with his agreement.
And
that agreement can be, he doesn't look at each little megabyte of information. That's obviously, that's a policy. He will make policies and arbitrate on particular cases and so on.
Andrew, how far down the 2.0 road do you think the Rudd government will be willing to go?
I think it'll go quite a long way down the road, particularly on that point about working to give public access to data banks and so on. I think that there will be a feeling that that makes a great deal of sense. I think the issue of actively promoting public servants' involvement in blogging and so on, I think there will be a lot more caution about that. I hope the caution doesn't go too far. For example, I always felt in the public service that I would very much like my young graduates who are moving up the field to maintain very close links with academia, to publish research papers, to go to academic seminars and be tested on them. So that the modern way of doing that is through blogs and so on as well. But I think
I completely agree with that.
The difficulty is going to be at the more senior levels who are actually directly working with ministers, and I think that becomes very hard.
Now, we've got to wrap it up. David, we're only months away, of course, from Tony Abbott getting into the lodge. Will he be open to 2.0?
I have to say that if there's someone who has put himself out there and opined widely, you would be hard competing with that. Certainly Tony's a very sort of open person.
And yes, I think that's been visibly evident. Thank you very much, gentlemen.
But I think he is open, but I'm not too sure he want everybody else below him, the public service, to be open.
Oh, there's a bit of cynicism coming in there, I think.
Gentlemen, Nick Groom, Chief Executive of Lateral Economics, who chaired the Government 2.0 Task Force.
Thanks,
Andrew Podger, National President of the Institute of Public Administration Australia, and, as you've heard, a former Australian Public Service Commissioner, and David Moore, political consultant and former Chief of Staff to the then Minister for Indigenous Affairs, Mel Brough. Late Night Live, Radio National, abc.net.au/rn.